Politicians made this mess. We may have found a couple that want to help clean it up, and a couple cases where others remain committed to being the mess makers. Matt's mom, a moment of zen, and trending news. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From thenation.com, teachers are being trained to shoot their students. Within the first 23 days of 2018, there were 11 school shootings in the United States. In lieu of any serious discussion about gun control, there has been instead a proliferation of laws and bills that would arm teachers and train them to be able to kill.
Kill. So I thought we needed to train teachers to bring math and reading scores up.
Not to go to the gun range and practice their sights?
Yeah, I didn't know that was part of the job requirements now, to train teachers to, quote, kill. Maybe a little bit over the top language, right?
Yeah, it seemed very in your face.
Okay, it seems in your face, and we talked about this. Maybe there's a bias in this article, and maybe there isn't, but like any article, there is. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
Okay. However, this issue of gun violence in schools is something we have to pay attention to.
It's a real issue. Okay. It really is.
So from the point of view, let's, in fact, maybe we'll even do a devil's advocates here and say, hey, guess what? If you're going to be a teacher in today's school, you need to know how to protect yourself. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, if you're going to protect yourself, that doesn't mean hiding. That means actively taking out a shooter.
And possibly protecting other kids.
And protecting other kids. Mm-hmm. Now, this, though, the sad part of this, though, is the other frame that the author takes in this article, which is to train you as a teacher to be a shooter, who you have to imagine shooting.
Yes.
Is one of your students.
Yes.
Because when we're talking about school shootings, mostly we're talking about a student that is in front of you. And so in this article, the intensity of the description of being able to imagine the child in front of you and then being able to imagine you lethally pulling the trigger to kill that child is part of the training.
And what I thought was interesting is one of the teachers that went through this, they said, imagine a student. Mm-hmm. And most of the teachers imagine that one student that they don't like that sits in the back of the
Bonnie
room that
in
always
the back,
causes,
you
she's
know?
Talking all the time and she's causing problems.
Right.
And this teacher picked her favorite student.
Yeah.
And said, can I do this?
And in fact,
it was enlightening. It really was.
Well, in fact, they were told, you know what? That was probably the better way to go because it's to assume that making an assumption as to who might be the shooter could be the problem. And in fact, assuming the good student might mentally prepare you to, and this is the troubling aspect of this article, right? To kill one of your own students. And so the ending, though, of this article is to say, have we lost our minds that we are literally going to say that the gun problem that we have with kids shooting each other, the solution is in having teachers being able to kill school shooters as opposed to possibly looking at issues of gun control, maybe issues with dealing with kids and the problems they have, and that the easy way out is to arm teachers and say, teachers, look, just take them out. And if we are at that point, we as a civilization have failed miserably.
From SBS News Australia, no school until age 7, Finland's education lessons for the future. School isn't compulsory in Finland until the age of 7. There are no national tests, no rankings, no inspections, no selective schools, and very few private schools. For every 45 minutes of learning, students enjoy 15 minutes of play. I want to go to school.
You want to go to Finland?
I do. I'd totally start my education over.
Yeah. Up in the Arctic Circle, right?
Yeah.
Well, and it's the home of Santa Claus.
So it can't be a bad place.
It cannot be bad, right? Well, although we know about my issue with Christmas. However, we won't bring that into the article. Finland is one of these places that continues to, from the ranking side to When we look at who has the best education system in the world, they are always at the top. Mm-hmm. And people always ask the question, how? And when the answer comes out, what you just said is when people go, I don't get it. What do you mean they don't start school officially until seven?
There's no tests.
Not tests.
No ranking.
45 minutes of play.
45 minutes of work.
Wait, 45 minutes of learning. 15 minutes of play.
Every hour.
That's not once during the day. That's every hour.
Every hour, yeah.
Right? So put that into the context of an American second grader who goes to school at 8 a.m. and leaves at 2:30. The reality of that child, a second grader, who is 8 years old, mm-hmm. is that in that time span, they will maybe spend 15 minutes total in recess.
True, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Total. Now, this is the other part in here. This is through 12th grade that you get the break.
I love that. Right? That's amazing.
It's like, how in the world has their country not been, taken over by people going, I want to go to school here.
Right. Right. They're keeping it so quiet.
But, this is a great story. It's a great feel-good story for people who are out there saying, can it be done differently? Because that, I think, is why we want to talk about Finland and all the different statistics in here and different points is that can things be done differently?
And a lot of what people think is that it worked there, we can make it work here. You can't take that system that happens in Finland and make it exactly how it is and plop it into Chicago, into Philadelphia, into Madison.
No.
But there's lessons to be learned from.
I'm going to say, but we can take philosophical stances mm-hmm. that they take about childhood, right? And what they say about what matters about being a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Play. It matters.
Yep.
And guess what? It doesn't just matter in Finland, because we actually have really good early childhood research on kids that actually shows that it doesn't matter if you're a kid in Finland or if you're a kid in Chicago or if you're a kid in Milwaukee, that play is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can take some of what's going on in Finland and learn. The question I always wonder is, why don't we?
Well, what is the reasoning behind that? Because you think this would be glaringly obvious. Another thing I noticed in this is they said teachers, you have to fight to become a teacher.
Oh, my goodness. Can you, what?
You look at this article and go, where's the magic falling out of it that it hasn't happened everywhere else?
And this is the kind of glaring issue that we have with Finland here in the country. And people, listener for Busted Pencils might be familiar with this, maybe not, but it's like every time we try to solve the school crisis, those of us who know always go, well, look at Finland. Here's another example. What is it about Finland that doesn't translate to saying we could do that here? For me, the reality is the people in charge currently of education reform in America don't want us to be like Finland.
Time for Tim to rant. This is Someone Has to Say
Teachers
It.
Unions. Right here, right now, let me say it. Teachers unions must do a better job at communicating the entrenched work they do at the community level. They must shed the wages and benefits only label, dig deep, reinvent them, and proudly claim the social justice mission. Teachers unions must become advocates. Advocates for children, advocates for schools, advocates for parents, advocates for communities, and advocates for the profession. When Governor Walker stripped collective bargaining rights away from teachers 6 years ago, I was a teacher educator in Pennsylvania. The local media there contacted me to set up an interview to discuss that issue of collective bargaining. They wanted to know why teachers should be, quote, entitled to a contract that was collectively bargained. It was very simple for me. I explained how collective bargaining allows teachers to negotiate for the conditions that create an environment that supports learning. Such things as working conditions, class size, teaching resources, aides, and planning time, all of that, benefits children. Even when it comes to salaries and benefits, the ability to bargain for a fair wage helps children. Teachers need to have some feeling of economic stability. This should be common sense. Teachers that have resources, time, small class sizes, and economic stability make better teachers. What parent doesn't want a better teacher? That was 6 years ago. Come on, teachers unions, help your neighbors understand how the loss of collective bargaining damages children, schools, parents, communities, and the profession. When children and schools benefit, the entire community thrives. Teachers unions must reclaim our schools for the children and families they serve. They must become committed to social justice. When the unions do this, our neighbors that don't get it might finally come to understand that a strong teachers union means a strong community.
This is Busted Pencils on 1510 AM Resistance Radio from Milwaukee Teachers Education Association, teaching all children.
Betsy DeVos, our Secretary of Education, is a perfect example of a politician that insists on making a mess of education, and she started with a food fight in the cafeteria, attacking the free lunch program. Look, it's simple. Hungry kids cannot focus on learning. I say, give them a free lunch. I wonder what Matt Damon's mom says.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
Betsy DeVos is quoted as saying, there is no such thing as a free lunch. What the hell did she mean?
No, I think she was making some kind of off-the-cuff comment about something Bernie Sanders had done. But what it made me think about, of course, now she's head of the lunch program, right?
Right, right.
But what it made me think about is and feel about is that we have 31 million kids in the U.S. who qualify for free lunch. And that makes me think about the sad fact that that the majority of kids in our public schools now are low income. 51%. Mm-hmm. So let's just acknowledge that we have just extreme income inequality in our country. So the fact that we're even talking about a free lunch, what is a free lunch? Really? And just not as a joke, but it's because kids are hungry and because their families can't afford enough food to feed them adequately that they get a free lunch at school. And that's a pretty sad situation in a country this wealthy, that we have that many kids who are poor.
Right. But how far off is it, though, when you think about what you just said? You know, okay, well, maybe she didn't actually mean anything about the free lunch program or the free and reduced lunch program we have in this country for hungry children. However, I'm not sure about that because was it a week or two later, the budget director for the Trump administration actually came out and said, you know, I'm paraphrasing his quote, but, you know, look, we have no tangible evidence that feeding children helps their achievement.
Yeah.
I mean,
no, they're trying. The Republicans are trying to cut back the free lunch program.
Yeah. And you're sitting there going, OK, first of all, I don't really give a poop if it has anything to do with achievement. How about the fact, as one person said, it makes a hungry kid unhungry? Or,
right.
You know, and so if you're not hungry, and that's a good thing. So if we're giving free lunches to hungry people and it stops them from being hungry, maybe that in and of itself is an okay result.
At the very surface of it, just feeding kids in school is a great idea. Kids need to eat pretty often, which most parents know. And, you know, having a good, delicious, healthy meal in the middle of the day for kids is a great thing for schools to do, regardless of their income level. Just a healthy thing to be eating well, and have a couple snacks too during the day. I mean, they're there for a long time, and some they need to eat, but also some of them, it's the only meal they get.
I used to keep Tic Tacs in the drawer and give them Tic Tacs for breakfast. No.
But many times,
when I was a second grade teacher, when I, you know, in rural Virginia, I had in my drawer, and it was actually the school nurse who came to me and gave me snacks. And she said, and she specifically told me, here are the students that you might want to offer these to at around a certain time, you know, because they knew the students, they had worked with them.
Yeah.
And the idea was that, you know, they're hungry. They're truly hungry. And so I look back at that and think, Man, was talk about, you know, 22-year-old teaching second grade in Virginia, and here I am, and somebody hitting me in the face truly with poverty and saying, look, you're going to need to feed these kids. And now here we are, you know, 30 years later, and we've got a multi-billionaire in charge of our public schools making off-the-hand comments about no free lunches.
You know, one of the things that's really hard for me about that is sort of is the hard-heartedness of the comments
right.
like that. And of any policymakers who make comments like it doesn't make any difference to kids' achievement, or some of the kids who get these free meals don't really deserve them or need them, you know, they're hard-hearted comments that just don't reflect any kind of compassionate society. And it's and any kind of compassionate attention towards children. It's really very discouraging to think that policymakers can say things like that and do things like that, you know, without some serious twinges on the conscience.
Well, that's why we have you, Matt Damon's mom, on the show, because there's always a free lunch with Matt's mom.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
He's a Milwaukee native, born in the city's poorest and nation's most incarcerated zip code. At age 25, he was elected to state assembly, where he emerged as champion on issues of the economy, criminal justice reform, and health care. He was also recognized as one of the top pro-growth progressive leaders in the country. And he's now running for lieutenant governor in the state of Wisconsin. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Mandela Barnes.
Hey, Tim, thank you for having me.
Okay, so the legislature wasn't enough for you, right? You needed more, so you decided to step up. I'm now going to run for lieutenant governor. Why?
So, you know, I thoroughly enjoyed my time in the legislature. I enjoyed the opportunity to present a vision of what I thought the state of Wisconsin should look like. From the perspective of the district that I represented in Milwaukee. So I'm running for lieutenant governor for a number of reasons. The main one being that this is our opportunity moment in Wisconsin. I do believe that Democrats will fare well in the November election. But on top of that, this is our chance to actually change the direction of the state, to not just win an election, but to be there in service of people, to actually push a meaningful, bold agenda. And that agenda can be outlined in what I've called the essentials of opportunity. That's economic progress, it's education, and it's environmental protection. These are three major issues that impact the state of Wisconsin, issues that we can lead on. We don't have to just be anti-Scott Walker. Over the last 8 years, people have come to know Scott Walker very well. Mm-hmm. They know where his shortcomings are. They know that we are a state that is seeing its middle class decline faster than most other states in the country. They know that Wisconsin is a state that's seeing 12% poverty. They know that Wisconsin is a state that has some of the highest income inequality since the Great Depression. And we still have not bounced back from the recession from 10 years ago. Mm. We are in a very slow growth economy, and the governor has done nothing to change that dynamic. And it's very unfortunate. It's time for real leadership.
So it's not a – you're right. We know what Scott Walker is, so you're different.
Well, absolutely.
How?
So I'm, you know, and I won't just say for myself, you know, there are also many others.
Right.
I think the biggest difference comes from seeing those mistakes over the past 8 years and knowing how we can actually lead on education, how we can go back to a system, or actually I should say create a system that's more equitable for students and teachers as well, and overall and the state overall. The money that we spend on multiple systems in the state. It's very unfortunate and disproportionate to our public schools. I'm a public school graduate. I totally value my public education. But we have money going in places that it shouldn't, and it's becoming a total loss for our public schools. On the topic of health care, which is one of the biggest issues, not just in Wisconsin, but across the entire country, you know, we have a chance to expand our Badger Care system, which is it's a national model. And we can allow people to buy into that program as well. We have to create the access to quality and affordable health care. In terms of environmental protection, whether you're in the city of Milwaukee, whether you're in more rural areas, Clean and safe drinking water is a priority. Mm-hmm. Clean and safe air to breathe is also a priority. You kind of need those things to live.
Those aren't bad things.
They are not bad things, but unfortunately, you know, if you're in Milwaukee, there may be issues with the water that you drink. If you're in rural Wisconsin, there may be issues with the water you drink from contamination from CAFOs and high capacity wells. I mean, these are real problems that people are dealing with, and these are real problems that the governor has chosen to ignore.
Well, we're going to jump on one though for now.
All right,
that's education. You hinted at it. You were talking about it. So right now, question to you: vouchers or no vouchers?
So the voucher program has disproportionately impacted our traditional public schools. What the voucher program is now is nothing like it was intended to be or how it was proposed. And so now you see across the entire state, there's just a report that was released that shows that the money that was originally intended for 400 or so schools across our state, that same pot will now have to fund up to 700 schools, around 700 schools. Could be more, could be less. But that is the impact of the voucher system. And whatever school that receives public dollars, there has to be some public scrutiny. Like, you have to be accountable to the taxpayers. And that's not always the case. So those are some of my biggest hangups with the system, and also being able to deliver education to all children. And, you know, there's been a history of students with disabilities who've been discriminated against. There are students with some behavioral issues who may go to a private school and then end up in a public school. And also, I mean, let's not forget about the third Friday count, something that still has not been fixed in this state, which means that, you know, students that are counted on the third Friday, that is how funding is dictated. Now, whether or not the school decides to keep those children after the third Friday, they still get to keep the money. Right. And that's been a huge problem. It's become a cash cow. And too often we see schools open up, close in the middle of the school year with little or to no warning, leaving parents stuck to figure out where they're going to send their children. I mean, that's no way to operate a school system in any entity of government, for that matter.
Well, and so we're getting a little bit more deeply into both vouchers and choice. No, that's good, because I think, you know, they're tied together. And so you really gave us a nice look at vouchers and how, the lack of accountability when we're throwing vouchers out there, how they're now been expanded to people who maybe don't even really need them. But then when we look at the application into, quote, choice schools, this idea of what happens, you talk about this third Friday, this idea that if I operate a choice school, I take students from the public school on that third Friday, I count them as there. On that following Monday, I take the ones I really like, and then I send all the other ones back to the public school. But here's the part, and you didn't hit this hard enough, but what a lot of people don't realize, that choice money, that voucher money, stays at the school when the kid goes back to the public school.
Yeah, I didn't explain that in a potent enough way.
Okay.
I definitely mentioned that. That was a point that I intended to stress a little harder. But that's not fair. And, you know, it creates a system of inequality. And I guess the worst part is that over the years, the categorization of public schools as just being bad, that is one of the biggest problems, because, you know, the governor has always made Milwaukee the enemy. He's always made Madison the enemy. And if you could paint an entire school system as being not good or not prepared, it's very unfortunate, because the immediate thought is, yeah, a private school, well, that must mean it's a well-performing school. That must mean there are certain standards that have to be met. And rarely is that the case.
Right.
And that's the worst part about it. And you have people who will go on and make very outlandish comments or say things that are very, you know, problematic in respect to public schools.
It's the failing public schools narrative.
The failing schools narrative. I always use air quotes because, you know, there's no such thing as a failing school. There are communities that have been failed that in turn lead to schools that don't always meet the marks that they should be.
Well, and you know, you're running as a politician, but I've always thrown this back and say, you know, we don't have failing schools. We've got failed politicians that allowed our schools to fail.
Well, I'm running for an office that I don't hold yet, so I can agree. Okay. I can totally agree with that statement.
Now, when you win this office, I'm going to come back at you and get and see how see where we are on
Let
that.
Me tell you what we're going to do with public education. You know, it's all about meeting the needs of students. That's the biggest part. You know, students in Milwaukee, especially, where 1 out of 19 students is homeless. Right, so that's over 5% of the student population that is facing a significant disadvantage. How can you expect those students in high-poverty school districts that face all sorts of trauma, other underlying issues that aren't met, you can't expect them to be able to operate or excel at the same level as students in higher-income districts that don't face some of the same barriers to education?
Think about what you just said, the homeless one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Last night I was in Milwaukee for an event, minus 10 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Homeless.
Yep.
And you got to go to school the next day.
Yeah. And then, you know, and sometimes it doesn't always mean that a person is out on the street, but the level of instability, like if a person is moving from house to house to house to house, like how can you expect that person to, you know, be able, like some people do. And those are very miraculous stories. But for the most part, the average person that is dealing with that life situation will struggle, even as an adult. Like you can, people, you know, functioning adults, like if they have that level of instability, they don't perform as well at work, on the job. They don't perform, you know, as well as just operating in society.
I want to put a question, and it'll be for when we get back here. But put this, so we've got a poor student, they're homeless,
mm-hmm.
right? The fix then is high standards, accountability, making sure that teacher does that job. And when we're looking at students coming from impoverished situations, the solution is not to look at poverty, but to yell at and hold those teachers accountable.
That has been the solution proposed by both Democrat and Republican administrations. Unfortunately,
thank you for hitting the Democrats on that one too.
Well, you know, we have to, you know, come to terms with mistakes that our party has made before we can move forward and then gain the trust of the people moving forward. But coming to grips with that reality means that we propose better alternatives, means that we propose a way to right the wrongs that have been going on for generations. So with that being said, it is vitally important that we meet the health needs of students, which plays one of the biggest roles in educational outcomes, whether it's mental health, whether it is assessing the trauma, especially with students who live in high poverty communities or have been subject to violence, or even something that people overlook like eyesight. Because when you measure a student's reading scores, if a significant percentage of those students have poor eyesight, then chances are those students are also going to have poor reading scores, not because they can't read or comprehend, but because they just simply can't see. I mean, this is an issue that even Teddy Roosevelt dealt with. And Teddy Roosevelt's blue blood. He has, you know, he comes from a family of wealth, and
right.
you know, he put, in his biography, he said that when he first put on his spectacles, it changed his entire view of the world.
And that's true. So so there's a great example, right? Teacher accountability. But if a kid can't see, you're the teacher. I can yell at you all I want, Mandela.
Mm-hmm.
But your kids can't see.
Yeah, if you can't see, then.
But that's your fault, though, man. Yeah.
And that creates another problem.
Okay.
It creates another problem because there then becomes this a tension between the teacher and the student. You know, if you're sitting, you know, yelling at me, pressuring me to perform a task that I physically cannot perform, mm-hmm. there becomes a level of resentment. And then that is how some many other problems arise.
Okay, so good. So we're at least going to address some issues of poverty, thank goodness, accountability. But when we talk about measuring progress, because it is a massive issue in the schools, how do we, quote, everybody wants to know how is a school doing well? Is a child doing well? Is a teacher doing well? And we've seen that the number one way that we do this over the past 20 years is the high-stakes standardized test.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you on that issue?
So the high-stakes standardized test, it goes back to my previous issue, right? Like you have to first begin to measure students, like where are they going into the test-taking phase? Are they actually learning the materials? Are they prepared to even take these tests? Like an issue about, we'll take civics testing, for instance, mm-hmm. when, you know, it was proposed that all, you know, students should have to pass a civics test before they can graduate high school. Well, if civics isn't even taught in the schools anymore, how can you expect students to pass a civics test to graduate high school? So there are so many expectations, and it's it is right. We should have expectations. You send a child to school, you should expect that that student is learning. But when we set these expectations, are we helping students meet those expectations before asking them to get to a certain point and then blaming the teacher for not getting to that point?
And this is where I think, you know, the healthy politician recognizes their role in helpfully providing the structures, you know, the infrastructure. And when here we're talking about infrastructure for kids, trauma, healthcare, poverty, things like that. Well, what are you doing though, making education policy?
Yeah.
And then dropping that on the teachers and saying, here, we fixed education for you if you would just do it better. Comments there?
So all conversations with any field, whether it's education, whether it's the environment, you should have those professionals in the room as a part of the conversation. If you don't have the professionals in the room as a part of the conversation, but only set expectations on them, then you're gonna have problems because you don't have that real world on the ground, hands-on experience as a part of the decision-making process.
So if Mandela Barnes is elected lieutenant governor, he's going to come to Busted Pencils and say, yo, Busted Pencil listeners, I need some help.
Well, I'm definitely about getting people in the conversation who will actually be impacted by what we're talking about. And, you know, I'm not just going to show up with a stack of a standardized test and say you better get it right or else.
Well, and so that's great. I'm sorry to put you on the spot there, but
no, you're good.
It's always fun, though. That's what we do here on Busted Pencils.
Hey, it's all good.
thinking about the high-stakes standardized tests, and we pointed out the trauma the kids have, but one of the things we forget to talk about in one sense is the demoralization that happens to teachers then who are also in that equation who are set up for failure. Because if those needs of, as you said, you laid it out nicely, there are learning needs that need to be met before kids come to school. If those aren't met, and then you then hold a teacher accountable. We've now seen 20 years over this, and I talk to teachers now who are saying, I got to get out. Mm-hmm. I talk to people going, how do you manage to have students in teacher education? We tell them not to go into it anymore. I mean, what are we going to do about teacher demoralization?
So the teaching profession has been, it's been bastardized. You know, my mother is a retired public school teacher. So just over the years, I don't know how or why teachers became the enemy. But with that being said, anybody that goes in any workplace that feels undervalued will probably not perform at a desired level. So I'm not saying that we should, you know, have some big hug fest with teachers. I mean they deserve it for what.
Sure.
You know,
I mean,
what
hug
they
wouldn't be
with.
Bad.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but you know, respect people for the work that they do, and understanding the value that is in the profession, because we're talking about our children who will go on to become adults and ultimately keep this place running. We should have a little more, empathy there, and we should have a little more, we should have a more significant investment in the well-being of educators and making sure that they are actually equipped to help our children meet whatever, you know, level of expectation we have for them.
So if we did that then, you know, and I'll get to this, you know, some people say we have a teacher shortage. I actually like to say that we don't have a teacher shortage. We have a teacher exodus.
Yeah, I was going to say you can't just run people out of town and say that, where'd they go? Why aren't they here anymore?
So we've got demoralization, and so there's a shortage. And the part of that, though, and you talk about your mom became a teacher. She went through a quality program to get that teaching license. Right now, we see a lot of push from politicians to say the reason or the cure to the teacher shortage is to do away with teacher licensing, teacher education, teacher professionalization.
Yeah, I mean, if you simply, you know, like I said, value the profession, pay teachers for the work that they actually do, you would easily attract the best and the brightest candidates. You know, it's not rocket science. You know, it's simple logic.
Right.
But you know, we don't have a very logical decision making body at this moment when it comes to our state government.
Teacher deprofessionalization, yep, then is what we're looking at here, and that push, and as we move them out. So Mandela, talk a lot about education. I know you want to talk about the environment, the economy, those are other things. But if I want to know more about your education platform, I'm interested in your campaign, where should I go?
Yeah, you definitely check out the website, and that's MandelaBarnes.com. There's a link to the issues. You know, I have a long history of support and authoring legislation on issues of public education. That stuff is all on the state's website. There's a link to news clippings, my own videos, to donate, whatever you want to do to get involved with the campaign.
Just check out
Facebook is facebook.com/TheOtherMandela.
Okay.
I am on Twitter @TheOtherMandela. I'm on Instagram @TheOtherMandela. So please feel free to come keep up with the campaign. We got a lot of exciting things coming up, and I want you to be a part of it.
Well, Mandela, thanks so much for your time. And what I want to say, what we say to our guests, man, thanks for busting pencils.
That's what we're doing.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
He is the current president of the La Crosse Education Association. This is his 20th year at Central High School in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Welcome to Busted Pencils, John Havlicek. Welcome.
Well, hello. Thanks for having me on.
So you are one of these union rabble-rousers, from what I understand, because the Department of Public Instruction of Wisconsin went up to La Crosse on their own time and had this open hearing to talk about teacher license revocation laws, and you're not so happy.
No, absolutely not. This is... They talked about some proposed changes, and there are a lot of problems with them.
Okay. From what I understand, though, this has been portrayed in the news when people talk about license revocation, if you're not saying, the ability to take a teacher's license and get rid of it. And the reason why we need new rules to get rid of teacher licenses is because you teachers seem to not understand the boundaries between what is appropriate behavior with students, and you guys can't seem to figure out how to not cross the wrong and bound or how to cross boundaries, and particularly issues of dealing with where are there sexuality issues and inappropriateness. And so the DPI has just put forward a bunch of rules that's going to stop you, John, from crossing those boundaries.
Well, you know, first off, yes, we all know that there are certainly lines that have to be defined, and we've been doing that for 50 years, for 100 years, for as long as there have been teachers and students, for 10,000 years. Okay. So absolutely, no one's saying that we should not have lines like that. But the issue at hand here is that the DPI was putting some very vague language into play to try to somehow standardize interpersonal relationships. And what they don't seem to be recognizing is that, you know, the relationships that we build with our students and with their families and with just members of the community are all unique. Mm. And what has worked, frankly, very, very well for, you know, years untold is simply to have the community standards kind of language that the La Crosse School District has, or the Wausau School District, or any school district in the state, okay, or in the country.
So, so this whole idea of putting together a whole new set of laws, though, it presents itself, and this is the part that actually bothers me, too, and I'm glad to be talking to a union leader here, because the issue is to assume that there weren't laws already protecting students from, quote, sexual predators, because for some reason this keeps getting framed as a sexual predator issue, as opposed to what you just said, these ideas of what are the boundaries that we have in the relationships that we create with students being in the teaching and learning business. And, you know, let's put this out there, though. What happened is that there are already rules for the dismissal and the taking away of license, quote, license revocation. The fact here is that this kind of did away with due process, from my understanding. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a real fear. Because, yeah, there were already very clear protections in place. And there's not a teacher in the world that's going to say that an inappropriate adult, inappropriate relationship between an adult, a teacher, and a student should be swept under the rug or anything like that.
Right.
Absolutely not. But what this language has done is it's really made things a lot less clear, a lot less understandable. So there was a language that says that, you know, just about anybody could file a complaint.
Mm-hmm.
And once a complaint is filed, then an investigation can be undertook. And once an investigation is undertaken, then all of a sudden it has to be public because it's part of a public record. And at no point so far has a teacher been able to say, whoa, hold on.
Right.
This is, you know, what really happened here. And because we have so many relationships with so many kids and so many parents, there's just bound to be misunderstandings. There's bound to be mistakes made. And once that's out there, you know, we talk about our students, or talk to our students about their carbon footprint. Once something like that is out there, now the teacher has not had due process. Now the teacher is your career is over.
Right.
For something that didn't even happen.
Yeah, so that's the part. This is all being framed around, quote, you know, sexual predators, and the reality is that, of course, we're going to get rid of sexual predators. We already have the laws on the books for that. We don't need any. And what you just said, where it's being presented as this makes it more clear, it actually muddies the water quite a bit, now relationships. And so you also do some work with providing food. And so you gave, and we talked, so there's an example where reaching out to a family in need of food could be construed by one of your colleagues as, quote, crossing a boundary that you shouldn't have. And now automatically, according to these new rules, a hearing has to happen, and it has to be a public hearing because John dared provide food for a hungry family.
Yes, I mean, you know, teachers and other, you know, adults in the education profession, we do so much more beyond the regular, you know, give some notes, score some tests, correct some papers. We do so much more beyond that, outside these walls, with these kids and their families and in our community. And a lot of that is going to be subject to interpretation. So, like you mentioned, I will drop off boxes of groceries for kids and their families. And so then, is that somehow going to be construed as, why did I stop at that kid's house?
Mm.
Well, I stopped at that kid's house to drop off groceries. Well, were the parents there? Well, they were there when they called me. Right. I guess I don't know.
Mm.
So, and then, you know, and then how things go, the little rumor mill and stuff. And I'm really concerned because education has been so politicized in our state, and our state's not the only one, that this could be used as a way to attack people. You know, I am a union leader. I have testified at hearings a handful of times now, and frequently to the chagrin of the people that were in the state legislature that were holding the hearings. And am I now going to have a target on my back? You know, that concerns me. And I think teachers should be concerned about that.
Well, it's you know, it makes you have this deeper question that we're not going to answer here today. But it's like, where did this come from? I mean, why now all of a sudden when we know we already have actually really clear rules on, quote, the inappropriate on the sexual interactions between teachers and student side? Why now create an ambiguous way to revoke teachers' licenses? I don't get it. People have actually called me and said, Tim, where did this come from? And I said, I don't know. My best look is that this is a regulation coming out of the Department of Public Instruction. And as to having its origin somewhere, I don't know where they are other than maybe within the legal realm of the department. Last minute here, John, do you have any sense as to where this is coming from?
No, I really don't. It's just astounding. And what it really makes me think of is the voter ID legislation, that this is a solution in search of a problem.
Well, John, I tell you what, this is not a problem that we want. No. You know, we teachers are out there working as hard as they can. The last thing we need is to have your license revoked for delivering food to a student whose parents weren't home and somebody felt that inappropriate. So, John Havlicek, La Crosse Teachers Union President, thanks for busting pencils, man.
Thanks for having me.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
He has been one of our favorite principals and guests on the show. Now he is running for mayor of Chicago. Before he takes on the Windy City, here is Troy LaRivière's take on the schools our children deserve.
They deserve schools where policy and practice are based on the best available evidence of what actually works in terms of creating the kind of education that ensures they achieve as much as of their potential as possible. And so what does that evidence say? That evidence says that they achieve, or they're far more likely to achieve, if they have a skilled and experienced teacher who has some expertise in curriculum and instruction, who understands the use of, for example, visuals and instruction, who checks for understanding, who can get them engaged, who has strong content knowledge. And so they deserve schools, or better yet, school systems that are far more likely to produce that kind of teacher. And that's not what they're getting right now. You know, they deserve schools where their role as residents and citizens is emphasized, where we think about what kind of adults we want to produce, that we want to develop for this society, in terms of their roles and responsibilities, not just as consumers and workers, but as voting members of the public. What kind of schools produce, what would happen in a school that produces a responsible citizen, someone who understands the issues of the day, someone who understands where candidates stand on those issues and can make a responsible and informed decision? What kind of schools would produce that kind of thing? You know, so right now at my school, for example, we have a program in place where our students are actually researching the history of various sites within the community and writing a history of those sites, right? And so they're learning the tools of historical investigation, right? They're learning the tools of interviewing someone and teasing out fact from fiction. They're learning the tools of finding the best evidence to support a particular perspective that they're going to have to take as they write their piece, right? And the same skills that they use to write that history are the skills they're going to need as, when they interpret history and when they interpret political events that are going to unfold in their lifetimes, decisions that they're going to, the events that they're going to have to make decisions about in terms of how they participate in the political process. So they deserve schools that prepare them for that.
Time for our tribute to legendary activist and historian Howard Zinn. This is your moment of Zinn.
The memory of oppressed people is one thing that cannot be taken away. And for such people with such memories, revolt is always an inch below the surface.
My thanks to Mandela Barnes, John Havlicek, Troy LaRivière, Matt Damon's mom, and you. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for busting pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.